And we've all discussed in the previous class, but just wanted to give you guys an outline of it's a pretty long paper, so thanks for reading all of it. But I'll just give you a brief outline as to the way I structured the paper. I'm thinking about changing it up a little bit, but we'll just begin from what I have so far. So I started off with just 3D printing capabilities. And this was relatively short because I wanted to focus more on the law rather than the different, I guess, technologies relating to it. And then next I talked about historical disruptive inventions. And when I was writing this paper, initially when I picked up the topic, I thought, wow, 3D printing is like something new, it's something revolutionary. So I wanted to compare past inventions that was kind of revolutionary to current 3D printing. I ended up more focusing on digital media and the analogy between digital media and 3D printing, but and then I kind of realized that there's digital media only covers the copyright portion of the 3D printing process. So so the next portion I focused on 3D printing and its effects on IP law. And I talked about how it doesn't neatly fit into either both copyright or patent because in order to create a 3D print, it's a transformative kind of object where it's first a drawing or a scan or whatnot, and then someone actually has to physically print it. So because there's this process going on, it actually goes through different, it affects different like types of law. Or, I'm sorry, different types, it touches upon different types of law. So when I was going through this analysis, I was thinking, okay, big picture view, you know, we have both copyright and patent law. I didn't focus on trade secret or trademark that much because I felt like copyright and patent were more relevant to the subject. So, you know, I wanted to back up and look at it holistically, like, okay, what does patent have and what does copyright have? And kind of compare and contrast, like, what are the missing elements between the different types of law and how it, I guess, how it complements each other and what parts I'm missing. So the first part, I just kind of talked about logistical problems in managing the 3D printing. And I emphasize on, you know, it's really not easy to stop piracy altogether. I think the whole point isn't to stop piracy, but how to manage it. And the reason why a lot of new, well, in my opinion,
that's fine.
My humble opinion is that the reason why a lot of, there are a lot of legal problems, especially like with the advent of digital media, and is because there wasn't anything set in place in terms of, there's not really a way for someone to do it legitimately without jumping through a bunch of hoops. And I think we've touched on this in our previous discussion. And so to me, that was kind of like the emphasis of like, how do we solve it? Let's not solve it from like how to stop piracy, but how to manage it. And then the next part, I go into the actual different portions of IP law. So uncertainty in distributing liability, lawsuit backlash, and incompatibility with, I talked about the different aspects of copyright and patent. So in copyright, problems with originality, authorship, excluding useful articles, and whatnot. I won't bore you guys. I'm sure you guys read all this. And in patent, I looked at I focused primarily on the CAD file, a discussion on whether or not CAD is protected or by patent law, and only because the easiest way to distribute a 3D print is by distributing a CAD file. And if patent liability can't cover PAD, then you know, there's maybe we'll have to focus more on copyright. And so the next part of my essay is proposed solutions, and it might be like completely out there, but I was just kind of using my knowledge and trying to figure things out. And but feel free to comment. This is a work in progress, and I would love to hear everyone's input and if you have any questions for me.
Great.
As well. Yes, hi.
I don't know if actually what is helpful to you is that I know I've heard some stories about, I've read articles where they're talking about maybe legitimate means were actually legitimate alternatives to piracy were actually put in place. There were huge drops in piracy rates. Like, I think in Canada, I read an article where in Canada they introduced Netflix, and over the next month, like, the digital downloads, down like 70%.
Yeah.
Maybe something like that might make your whole argument that it's a lack of access probably a little bit more force.
Yeah.
I totally think you're right, but I think maybe having that argument in the section might make it, or the evidence in the section might make it a little bit more forceful.
Yeah, definitely. That's helpful. Thanks. I try to emphasize that,
yeah.
You know, like, sometimes when digital music first came out, you know,
mm-hmm.
I thought going to DAW or LimeWire was, like, the fastest way to get the new song I wanted instead of, like, driving out to the retailer and, like,
yeah.
copying it from
the
CD.
And you're totally right. Like, it was so much faster to download it from somewhere. This is a tangent, but one of my good friends was a grad student, and at the university, they had full access to all Microsoft products. You could get free copies of any software they wanted, but it was more efficient to get, like, it was faster to get the legal copies online than to go and try and go through the legitimate means, which meant that even in their lab, they had people downloading illegal copies of software because it was faster.
So how do you make the legitimate version superior to the illegitimate version? That is, what can the archive that's got licenses from the patent holders do that the pirate archive can't do so as to make it more attractive?
I think we touched on this on our discussion previously, maybe add incentives, like, oh, if you actually buy the real copy, then I'll throw in something else with it, or... And also there's always the risk of a virus, which was an issue with digital media or songs, digital songs as well. Like,
so one thing they can do is to say, we have a reputation, you know where to find us and sue us if you get a virus from us.
Mm-hmm.
The pirates don't,
yeah.
So that's one reason to trust our quality. What else can they do?
Put
it differently. Suppose you're a pirate archive. How are you going to limit what you're doing because of the fact that you know that you're violating patent law? Right, so you're a pirate archive, and you would like to make it as easy as possible for customers to find products and as hard as possible for patent holders to find products.
Mm-hmm.
How will that limit what you can do in terms of how you prevent your products?
The first thing that pops into my mind is kind of like an underground, like, society where only certain people are allowed into this, I guess, database group, as long as they're not patent holders. But that's kind of hard.
Very hard to do.
Yeah, that's really hard to do.
But let's turn it around. You're a patent holder.
Yeah.
There, you know there are pirate archives out there. How do you find whether they've got your product? It's not like music where you can check and see whether the file fits your file, right?
Yeah. You mean, like, you can't really tell from just... having a CAD file.
They've got a million CAD files
yeah.
up on their server, and you want to know if one of them is for you, is make a trademark. One of them is for that nice hat he's wearing, which you, as whatever SF stands for in this case, have a intellectual property claim that you should get paid 15 cents anybody makes that hat. So how do you find that file?
So I know with digital music, you can, like, just take a snippet of a song and be able to match it. I don't know if there's software that people will eventually develop to see that if there is a combination of a certain, like, I guess, I don't know how CAD files exactly work, but if, like, the program of
the CAD file is a description of how to build the thing.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be a copy of somebody else's CAD file. As the thing on the song
uh-huh.
is that the song is typically, I think, a digital copy of something that the copyright holder has got in his hands and can therefore compare it to. If what you imagine is that the way the CAD file came into existence was that the licensed owner up in the legitimate archive had a CAD file of it, and somebody downloaded that CAD file and then uploaded it to the pirate, then you'd be in the same situation as music. You could then say, I know not only what the product looks like, but what the file looks like, and I can look for a match. But if you imagine instead that the person who's uploading the CAD file either created it himself, and it's violating a patent. After all, he's violating a patent. Doesn't even have to be making a copy of your product. He could be making a copy of a different product that uses the idea that you've covered. Or even in that case, he does it by scanning. Or maybe he downloads the official file and then modifies it in ways that don't affect what it prints out, but affects what it looks like. The equivalent for software, which is in a sense the closest equivalent, is recompiling. I don't know if people are, everybody knows what that means. Yes, no, oh. The way you write a computer program is to write it in some human-readable language like C or BASIC or something. There is then a computer program called a compiler which converts what you've written into machine language that the computer can read. One way of evading copyright, potentially, although it's not a legal way at this point, is to take the machine code, use another program to reverse the process, get it back to a source code, recompile with a different compiler. Since there isn't only one way of turning source code into machine code, right? The source code says what it does, but it doesn't tell you whether you put this number in memory location 6,000 or memory location 7,000. So, therefore, if you recompile with a different compiler, looked at just as a string of digits is entirely different. Hence, if you...
How feasible is it to turn object code into source code? Is it easy? I was under the impression that it was pretty hard.
To turn it into readable source code in order that you can then change the program, I think, is hard. But I believe, though I may be mistaken, that there are... Our decompiling programs, which will turn it into an unannotated source code, and therefore a source code where it would be a whole lot of work to figure out why we're putting this number into that memory location. But you don't have to for this purpose.
Yeah, if you're just trying to get it compiled again.
That's right. I think that's right. I've done some programming, but I'm really not a programmer, so I wouldn't claim that I know for certain. And for any purists in the field, BASIC was originally an interpreted language, not a compiled language. Well, there are also compiled versions of BASIC. An interpreter means that every time you run the program, it's being translated as you run it, as opposed to translated once and then run as machine language. So I guess that would be... Other people have suggestions, all right? Imagine you are the proud owner of the right to make that cap. And I, evil person that I am, you suspect... you know that I've got a pirate archive, and that pirate archive, some of your friends tell you they've downloaded other sports caps from it, and you want to know whether I'm pirating. There are two of them. I bet one of them, of course, you scanned that one, and then he did it in a 3D printer just for the class. I understand. What is SF, by the way? San Francisco something?
Giants.
The Giants. I think I'm old enough so that the Giants are a New York team. I think they were a New York team, but I was never a baseball fan. It is baseball, isn't it? Yeah, Douglas. What? Yes, I'm older than that. But I wasn't a fan then either. And I still think of Brooklyn as Dodgers. Anyway, and I think they're somewhere else too. No loyalty these teams have. Yeah?
I was wondering, a lot of customers have authenticity. So if you could have a way to... kind of like with how we protect against counterfeit bills, some kind of way that it'd be really hard to mimic the actual similar and then use that, and then so people who actually want to authenticate that
In a sense, a related case are Visa cards, which have a little, I think, holographic image on them, which I'm sure there are ways of forging them, but presumably it's harder to forge it than it would be if it wasn't there. But this really assumes that the customer wants the provably authentic one instead of the one that looks just the same. But is what you want to declare your loyalty to the San Francisco Giants, or what you want is to show that you have been authorized to declare your loyalty by the San Francisco Giants?
Well, this hat has a seal on it.
Uh-huh.
So this is an MLB official seal.
Right. And does that matter?
To me, no. But to a lot of people,
it does. You think it does, right? That's the interesting question, yeah. Because, of course, if it does, we don't even need the seal. All we have to do is have the official people publicize the fact that if you get it from anywhere other than our authorized distributor, it's probably a fake.
Right.
And that would be one possible. That is, let me go back a bit. One possible approach to the judge, this is, from my standpoint, this is really the same problem, the same set of issues as what I refer to as the death of copyright. All right. The fact that as technology changes, some forms of law become hard to enforce, and then one solution is to try to keep enforcing them, and another way is to find ways or find other ways of achieving the objective. And one way of solving the death of copyright is tipping. All right. One way is to say I put my novel up on the web for free, and I have some simple, no trouble way. Click on this button, and 50 cents from your PayPal account gets transferred to me. And that's an interesting question because in one sense we know it works because we know that people routinely tip waiters and cab drivers. Right? Cab drivers are the best case because in the case of a waiter, if you go to the restaurant regularly, maybe the reason you're tipping him is to get better service next time. Cab driver, you know you're never going to see him again. And yet, I don't know, I looked up the numbers about 40 years ago when I was thinking about the question. But certainly people spend billions of dollars total in tips, whatever the numbers now are. And that's purely a sort of social pressure feeling of obligation. So let me put this question for a moment. Suppose that a novel you wanted to read was up on the author's webpage as an ebook, and what it said was, pay what you want, but you can pay it by clicking on this button. So it would take you only 20 seconds to say how much you want and put in some kind of information about your PayPal to do it. So it's no trouble. How many people here think that when they download it, assuming you wanted to download the book, then you download it, you would pay anything?
That I wouldn't pay?
That you would.
Something.
All right. How many people think they would pay more than 50 cents? More than a dollar?
Depends.
Yeah. I'm just trying to remember my royalty rates. Yeah?
There actually was a real life example of that. Mm-hmm. Cards Against Humanity is a game, and they had an expansion pack where people were allowed to pay whatever they wanted. And I don't remember exactly how it broke down, but they actually ended up making more profit by letting people pay what they wanted than their standard price, which was $5 for an expansion.
Uh-huh.
So I read an article that there is a real world example of exactly that.
If you can find the article, why don't you email it to one or more of these students who had papers on this, and they can maybe incorporate the reference, because it sounds relevant. Yeah?
Yeah, in the music context, the band Radiohead did that also.
And how well did it work?
I heard that they made a decent amount of money, but there was a lot of people that just downloaded it for free through that system, which was allowable. But they also did make a lot of money off of it as well, so it's hard to tell.
Yeah. The case that I'm thinking of is a much older case. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with it, but for some reason, J.R.R. Tolkien did not have a copyright on Lord of the Rings in the U.S. And a legal pirate edition came out. All right, a very popular book, had copyright in England, I don't know what were the formalities required at the time, but a edition came out, and Tolkien noticed and was very upset about it, and had a second edition, authorized edition, brought out by another American publisher and publicized. You know, if you don't want to cheat the author of this book you love, buy the authorized edition. And my impression was it succeeded. I don't know. You know, I didn't follow it in a lot of detail. But that's, again, a very special case, because that's a book where people who like it an awful lot. And that's why I was sort of curious. Let me turn the question around for a moment. If a book, nowadays, how much do you normally pay for a book, for the books you actually buy? What? About $20. So if it's $20 and if the royalty rate is 8%, and I think that's a not impossible royalty rate, that's $1.60. So the question is, how many people would tip more than $1.60 on a $20 book that they wanted? So probably, yeah. So that would suggest that maybe you can't do as well. Now, of course, there's the counter argument. Is that maybe you'll sell a lot more copies when they're free than when they cost $20. So you might still make more money even if people gave you less per per book, but it's anyway. But it does seem to be that one of the questions that one ought to have in mind on all of these issues are what are the other ways of getting pay, and one of them is people's feelings of obligation, gratitude, desire to feel generous, and so forth. Yeah.
I think one of the underlying questions too is what. Are we always going for maximizing money? Because some artists, if they're especially if they're just starting out, they might be seeking attention more than they are dollars at the beginning. Whereas there's an established musician who's going to get the money anyway. Maybe they shy away from things that are spreading it out. Like I know Metallica didn't digitally release their music up until just very recently, and they had strong record sales up until that point, and then when they released it to Spotify and all these alternative means, it actually did cut into their record sales significantly.
Well, I'm in this situation. I've got, as you may or may not have noticed, my webpage has got about 5 different books up on it for free as PDFs. But that's not how I make my living. And from my standpoint, in fact, I don't have any jars either. I get no money directly. I only get it in the form of things like speaker's fees if people have come across me from that. But from my standpoint, I'm writing my books mainly to spread ideas. And there is the argument that novelists are people who want to be novelists, not people who want to make a living as novelists. And I'm not sure how true that is. But there are certainly different motives that possibly go into it. But in a sense, the cleanest case is if you've got a way in which you can make as much money despite not enforcing copyright law as you could have made enforcing copyright law, and then copyright law isn't a problem anymore if that's the case, and that's what we're thinking about in all of these. I'm just thinking of it. Another interesting example occurred to me. How many people are familiar with the game Magic the Gathering? All right, which I like to refer to as Magic the Plague, but you could easily enough, given the tools many people have, make your own cards. All right? You could pirate cards, not even going online. If you're just thinking, well, what are they? Printed cardboard? It's not that hard to make printed cardboard. You could scan in with a color scanner, which lots of people have, print it out on glossy paper. Probably somebody who's paying attention could see that it wasn't the real thing. You could also invent your own cards. You could just scan in one of them and then change its characteristics to make it a really super powerful card. And yet I don't think it's happening. And I don't think, yeah?
I do that all the time.
You do it all the time?
Yeah. You don't even have to scan them. They just have the whole picture on the internet. You swipe it off the internet, print it out on a piece of paper, and then slap it.
Interesting. And do you also modify it?
I don't change them, although I had once or twice in the past just for giggles. Yeah.
That's interesting.
But that would destroy the balance of the game.
That's what's interesting. The reason I was thinking of that case is that I would have thought there would be a sort of a social pressure that is cheating to...
You have to have a group to do it with. You have to have an agreement with like 3 or 4 other people.
That you can make your own. So you're making your own variant of Magic the Gathering. And you then can't play it in the tournaments that they do, but you can play it with your friends. That's interesting. Yeah?
Have you talked about Kickstarter in this?
I don't think. Have we discussed Kickstarter at all?
Not directly. Okay.
Talk about Kickstarter.
I think the way it works, you put up an idea on Kickstarter, and then people can offer to pay money. So I don't think they pay it immediately, but once you've got a sufficient amount of funds, then it charges everybody.
That's right. You're making, I don't know what the technical term is, but you're basically making a commitment, which I think you can't back out of, though I'm not sure. I think it's like making, like if you, sometimes when you buy things online, you pay with your credit card and they say we won't charge your credit card until, you know, we've got the good, until we ship the good or something. And I think it's something like that, so that I believe, though I am not sure, that once you've committed, you can't back out, but they can cancel it if they don't raise enough money and do.
Okay.
I think that's how it
is.
I think what's happening is that you are contributing $20 from your credit card. You are not billed. Maybe there's a hold on the money. I'm not sure. Because I know when you do things like renting cars, they sometimes put a hold on the money. And then if they don't reach the amount they said, it's all canceled. But if they do reach it, you're paying the money and you're getting whatever it is that you're getting in exchange. Anyway.
Okay. Yeah, so I was wondering, what about that mechanism for a lot of these IPs, whether it's like books or something like that?
And then the question is, how willing are you to contribute in advance if you believe that once it, that you're one person out of 1,000 fans, it's unlikely that your contribution will make the difference between success and failure. How likely are you to say, well, in that case, why don't I just wait? And if it works, then there will be pirated versions I can get for free.
So it overcomes, is it called a coordination problem?
Called what?
A coordination problem where you can't agree with it.
I would have called it a, I guess, a public good problem, but see, there, in a sense, this is not new. One of the ways in which I believe books were being published in the 18th century, and maybe before that, was by subscription, where you would have somebody who would say, I'm planning to write the following books, and I'm collecting subscriptions, and people would basically buy the book in advance, and I don't know, they probably were actually paying, I don't think they didn't have credit cards, and then when the book finally comes out, maybe he's written the book but it hasn't been published because there are costs to setting type and printing, then they get a copy. And I'm, my impression is that was a fairly popular way of producing books back in the 18th century, so it'd be interesting actually for somebody, maybe if I ever teach this course again, which I probably will, for someone to look at that history and see how that did or didn't work as an interesting alternative model. But I want to go back to my question though, because you, somebody here is the copyright holder on that cap, or the trademark or whatever it is, and you want to find out if the Pirate Archive has it. What's the obvious way of finding out? You say to yourself, if I were a customer looking for that cap, how would I query the archive? And you say, well, let's see, let's put in a search term, baseball cap. List of baseball caps. Well, the customers want to know what it looks like, so let's click on the one that says SF. Huh, looks just like my trademarked one. Now, assuming that I'm lucky enough to have found a Pirate Archive, someplace I can get at them, which I may not have, but if I have, I can now go after them. So what that suggests is that there is at least some conflict between the desire of the Pirate Archive to be accessible to its customers and its desire not to be accessible to patent holders. And my guess is that if you were thinking about something as simple as that cap, it's going to work, that you're going to be able to find it. But if you're thinking about the patent problem, it's probably not going to work, because I holding a patent, it's not at all obvious what the people who want the product are going to be looking for if the product infringes my patent. You know, if the product is a direct copy of my product, then I can probably do it. But if the product is something else using the same principle, then it's hard to know. I can't. But it just seems that that's sort of one of the issues you want to think about in terms of your solution is one advantage of your solution, one advantage the legal archive has that is respectable. One advantage is that it's got a reputation, it can be found, it therefore can more or less guarantee to be virus-free and so forth. One interesting question, which I don't know the answer to, is it illegal if the legitimate archive puts up some fake pirate archives and fills them with viruses? And I don't, anybody know what's the legal status of that? I'm running a legitimate archive. I want to make sure I don't compete with pirate archives. So I set up in various places on the web under various names what purport to be pirate archives, and I give them my own, some subset of the stuff in my archive. I've got it available. It doesn't cost me anything to copy it over, except that every file is polluted in some way. Some of them turn out that cap, and it looks just like the cap, except it's the mirror image of the letters, or it's the wrong color, or there's a virus on the thing. I put that up on my archive, and then after a while, people only buy from me. Have I broken any laws? And I should say, just to play safe, my pirate archive says when you enter it, we are not able to guarantee the quality of these files. So use at your own risk. Downloader, beware. Any opinions on whether you're the lawyers, right? You're going to be lawyers. I'm not going to be a lawyer, never. Yeah?
I think a virus, just by releasing it anywhere, it'll substitute to some.
What if you didn't create the virus, but only distributed virus that was already out there in the wild? You think it still is? Yeah. You may well be right. I don't know. How about my other version? How about if I just pollute it by making all the files not quite work?
I don't think that's fine.
Yeah?
I think what they're more likely to do is put some sort of tracking code in there that will take your IP address so that they can try to sue your systems.
You mean the people who go to the bogus pirate site?
Yeah, who download the file. And the file has some code in there that gives you some personal information from your side back to them. The flip side to that is that there's software too that disables any outward signal.
Yes, but you could use it to try to locate people, and then the problem is that since patent doesn't have statutory damages, it's going to cost more to sue everybody than you're ever going to collect from them, isn't it?
It's more from a copyright angle.
Yeah, it's going to be.
And then I know that the rights owners in copyright material, they actually hire companies. There's entire companies that where all they do is go through YouTube and other similar sites and just search for pirated content, flag it, and then they collect all that information and send out massive cease and desist. And then if they want, now they have all that information that they can use to go to trial, and they go after, like, the Google Duke Viacom.
But it's going to be much harder to do this with patent than it is with copyright, because of the point I was making before, the patent, it doesn't have to be identical to the... Yeah?
What if you create a tarkey system? And you told people, I own this content, I'm going to set up a reward program. If you find this content, let us know. You earn points, you have an account, you get to show off, how many times you've reported illegal stuff.
That's interesting.
And you motivate the users themselves to sort of self-police this content.
Think of it as open source copyright infringement, yeah. Copyright enforcement or patent enforcement. It's an interesting idea.
I don't know if anyone's done that successfully. I was reading an article about the Business Software Alliance, which was in January this year, creating this end user reward program where you would sort of report unauthorized copying or distribution of copyrighted software. And then they would investigate it, and if they found that it was, in fact, an unauthorized copy, you get some sort of credit, and they have all these numbers here. I don't know, but supposedly, up to $5,000, and then that goes all the way up to $1 million. If the settlement that they end up getting is $15 million, so it's based on the damage that they actually get.
Yeah.
From the
that's an interesting. So anyway, I think all of these are sort of issues that are sort of it's fun to think about how you might deal with it. Do people have other comments for our
target? I was reading an article about a guy who was playing Legos, but he was making them within 3 microns of the actual size of the Legos, and he wasn't actually putting a Lego logo on. So is that, he seemed to not, and there was a term in the article saying that they didn't think that was infringing anything particularly.
Does Lego have a patent? Probably, it's probably expired long ago, right?
So I'm wondering if they were printing stuff that wasn't identical in size and didn't have a logo, would that be like infringement?
I think that goes into like whether it's substantially similar. I think it's like very fact specific.
Was he selling them or doing them for himself?
Himself, his kid.
Very hard.
I think that you really have to look into his
stuff. All right. Other questions? Would our next contestant like to come up? Thank you.
So I hope I'm understandable because English is not my first language, but I will try to make myself understand. So as the other presentations discussed, 3D printing is a new technological invention that makes it possible to print 3D prototypes by using a CAD file and relaying the information to the printer. I looked at the pros and cons of this invention, and my argument is that I believe that 3D printing is a great invention and provides a lot of benefits for individual consumers and businesses. For example, the defense industry and the automotive industry that can generate low production costs and experiment with their product. About in addition to the possible benefits, there's definitely some downsides, and my paper is going to focus mostly on how 3D printing is a potential or actually a threat to innovators who who have a patent on their invention. My recommendation is that innovators and 3D printers manufacturers should work together to create a system that protects the ideas of innovators without limiting the possibilities of 3D printing. So a possible solution, but the others also mentioned it, was make it possible for people to download 3D model files and pay a small fee for that. So I think a good program is iTunes, so similar to iTunes one, so that people can find all possible 3D models that they want and pay a small fee. So a possible way to prevent further infringement when a file is uploaded is the notice and take down policy. So the owner of a website can be summoned to remove a document on his or her website. So so others can't download it anymore. What I also thought was that the website owner could like thread the downloaders the uploaders to not upload files because their identity could be released. And it's kind of difficult because I know a lot of people are on the internet anonymous, but maybe by using the IP address of people so that people are scared like I'm not uploading files because they can come after me. Also, do I think that the government should like make people aware of that it's a tort and that people shouldn't do that? Because I think a lot of people don't know it, don't know that IP exists and etc. Another thing was that I thought that manufacturers of 3D printers could like put a that the manufacturers have like a requirement for their 3D printers, so that the printers could only print files that are approved. But that's kind of shaky because there are also people who design their own files, so and they need to be printed too. But there are a lot of things to think about, like on the subject. But because the internet is kind of, I feel like we don't have any control over the internet, but I'm working on it.
So how do you, in order to sue people, how do you find out that they've got your content there in the first place?
Oh, but that's like with the notice and take down policy, so that website owners.
To do that, you have to know. But how? First, are you thinking about copyright or patent infringement?
Yeah. So
which? I'm infringing your patent.
Yeah.
That means I have made something which uses an idea that's patented. Mm-hmm. How do you find out that the CAD file on somebody's server is for a device that violates your patent?
But what if you think?
How do you find it? There are a million files on that server. How do you find out that one of them has anything to do with your patent?
That's difficult, but if you think that's my or it infringes my patent, then you could like let the website owner know.
If you believe it infringes it, you can tell them, and you can then argue, as someone said last time, that they're guilty of contributory infringement if they keep doing it. But that requires you to find it. And it seems to me that one of the fundamental problems in these various proposals is that the comparison between things like songs or computer programs and 3D CAD files works if what we have is a pirated CAD file, but it doesn't work if what we have is our CAD file for an infringing machine. Mm-hmm. Because the CAD file for an infringing machine doesn't look at all like the CAD file for your machine. So how do you find it? How do you recognize it? Well, think about that. Other people.
I feel like this might be a problem that's independent of 3D printing, and it's something where if people are going to copy your stuff for their own personal use or reverse engineer it somehow, then that's just something that you don't have the resources to police. But if it's something to where they were going to copy it and then distribute it on a level that would actually harm you, you would sort of know by then that they were a competitor because they have to be putting themselves out there.
Except that if what they're doing is printing many copies and selling them, moving physical objects around is pretty visible. But what if what they're doing is creating a CAD file and putting it up on a server in Timbuktu? Now you've got a much harder problem, right? Now you might say, well, in order for them to get, after a while, if they're doing very much of this, after a while you somehow discover there's a machine out there that seems to be using my device, and you then say, well, how did people find it? And so forth. So maybe there are ways of finding it, but even then, if the server's not in the U.S., you may have problems doing anything about it. So, other comments?
Yeah. So I guess that assumes that by the time they find a real problem, 3D printing will be available in everyone's household. And then once that file hits the internet and people start leeching off of it, you'd have to almost have a massive IP tracking system to be able to track every IP address that comes into contact with the original file and all subsequent redistributions of it through seeding and leaching. It would be enormously
but just think of the fact that after we tell the NSA they've got to stop tracking all of our phone calls, they've got nothing else to do, and they're perfectly equipped to do this job, right? Think of it as an employment project for the National Security Agency.
Yeah, we do have resources available.
After the Soviet Union collapsed, there was a conference at Stanford that I was part of on ways in which terrorists could do damage over the internet, basically. And it was an NSA project, pretty clearly. And I was wondering if it was a real problem or just an NSA employment project, because they had just lost their main purpose of existence. And sort of my feeling was, yes, indeed, a sufficiently competent saboteur could do a lot of damage over the internet, but he could do a lot of damage in ways that don't require the internet. Too, you know, an appropriate amount of ANFO and fuel of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil will make really big dings, as was demonstrated. So it wasn't clear that it made much sense. But anyway, but it is an interesting thought for me. It's something that you might want to explore. Imagine that you have the resources of the NSA, and you really want to enforce the law. Now, my guess is that given the current status of 3D printing, it makes no sense that the most serious thing is going to be copying that cap, and that's not a very big issue. But suppose you reached the point where you believed it was essential to enforce patent law and where 3D printing was good enough so that if you could only get the CAD file, you could make practically anything. You could then imagine a NSA project. And what do? They keep a track of who communicates, everybody communicates with everybody, essentially. It's a complete PAN register for the U.S., which they're doing anyway for phones. And then they say, all right, we will hire people who go out trying to find infringing products. Anytime they find an infringing product, they identify where the server is. We then use our PAN register to find everybody who's been in touch with the server. Everybody's in touch with those people. We've been in touch with those people. Analyze the spider web of connections and show up at your door and say, we have reason to believe that you've got 6 objects in violation of patent law. So I'm not sure it's at all practical. Might be a good science fiction story, actually, if you think about it. But it's one of the things, I think one of the things that's worth thinking about in all of these contexts. I'm saying one thing to think about in all of these issues is, if you can't enforce it, how else do you produce IP? A different thing to think about is, what extreme did you have to go to enforce it in various environments, in various contexts? Yeah, you were going to say something? Yeah.
No.
All right. Yeah?
It just seems that would be extremely inefficient. Because it seems like a factory, no matter how good 3D printing can get, a factory can mass produce those things for cheaper per unit, and then just sell those for cheaper than to actually produce individual households to go and print out whatever it is that they're trying to print out.
In a sense,
and then you would have all this cost from trying to track down everybody and see if it matches a patent. It's just, yeah.
Yeah. But we've got to solve the NSA unemployment problem, you see. But it seems to me that part of the issue here is how large a part of the cost of the IP is. That there's a sense in which you've got a sort of a double bind here. If the patent license only adds a penny to the price of the product, then it isn't worth going to a lot of trouble to infringe it. But you could say if it only adds a penny to the price of the product, there's not much of an incentive to invent things anyway, that there are lots of other ways, first mover things and so forth. Whereas if the IP is a really major component that is really expensive, if you think about pharmaceuticals, then the difference is not a small difference. You know, take the pharmaceutical case. Maybe that's a good one, too, because that's probably the case where the largest fraction of cost is ultimately paying for IP. So if you then say, all right, suppose our 3D printers are good enough so they can do chemistry, which nanotech is going to be able to do eventually, probably. So we now download your patented medicine and cure dealing with my, what was it? There was a... it was that the Indian drug was like $90,000 a year was the kind of figure being quoted. Well, if I can print it myself for $100 a year and it costs $90,000 for the manufacturer is not going to sell any. So that would, I mean, I think it is worth thinking about. That's partly why I was thinking going back to the books about how large royalties normally are. And if royalties are a relatively small amount, then it's much more plausible that you can get people by sort of social pressure to pay it. Whereas if books were mostly royalties... And you might argue that once you have e-books, books are going to be mostly royalties. All right? That if currently, what is that $20 paying for? It's paying for printing and distributing and all the rest of that stuff. But if we do all of that as a Kindle, all of that goes to practically zero. And now maybe the only cost is the IP cost, and then people have an incentive to evade that. Anything else for... I wish you could persuade the National Security Agency of that, because they don't think so. That is, as you may know, are people familiar with the distinction between a wiretap and a pen register? Pen register, this is old technology, is something which keeps track of who called whom when, but not of what they said. And my understanding is that it is at least the government's position, and I think they've got a basis for it in past law, that you don't need a search warrant for a pen register. You do need a search warrant to listen to the... Now, the question I raised in a book some years ago, and I'd be intercurious because I wouldn't be surprised if, in fact, I'm sure NSA has thought about it. Suppose that we record what you say, but no human being listens to it. We record what you say, we do speech-to-text software, we run it through a computer, and the computer then says, boss, I think you ought to look at this. At that point, have I yet required a search warrant? Or could I say, well, no, nobody has read it. At this point, I go to the judge, and I say, well, look, there were 17 million messages that we did this with. Five of them, boom, it said, we found text in this which makes us think it's terrorists. That's our basis for asking for a search warrant. Now we want permission to listen to those five. Any opinion on that? Yeah?
I think as far as the Fourth Amendment also requires a high level of evidence before further probation and probity, it feels that because now you have a situation where you're going to get a lot of false positives.
Okay, depend how many. That's where I was imagining that you went through many millions and you only found five. I agree. If what happens is that we say that out of 15 million, 300,000 hit the button, and we suspect that that's four terrorists, then arguably it doesn't do it. This goes back to something which I wrote about a long time ago in book Future Imperfect, which is that the real limitation on wiretapping in the past is not court orders. The real limitation was it was expensive. Because in order to do wiretapping, you have to have a human being listen to lots and lots and lots of phone calls, only a small fraction of which matter. And so I was arguing there that once you have speech-to-text software, computers work very cheaply. And in fact, I actually did say in print like 8 years ago or something that you could be tapping every phone in the country. There was a movie, I don't see very many movies, but a movie I liked and remember called The President's Analyst, in which there's this wonderful scene. It turns out eventually that the bad guys behind the bad guys behind the bad guys are the phone company, and that the phone company has no human beings in it at all. It's entirely automated at this point. And there's this scene where the protagonist, who is the president's analyst, whoever he's trying to get at to influence the president, goes into a phone booth on a rural road, and he calls up a buddy of his who's a CIA agent, and, you know, come help me. And he hangs up. Down the road comes a truck, a phone company truck, with a, thing for picking things up on the back and some phone booths in it. Picks up the phone booth with him in it, puts it on the back of the truck, replaces it with an empty phone booth, drives off. 2 minutes later, helicopter comes down, CIA agent, along with a Russian NKVD agent who's currently an ally of his, and they look at this empty phone booth. And the CIA agent says, it can't be. Every phone in America tapped. They're using you on Russia! and the point I made was it is now doable. It wasn't doable at the time. And I think NSA is doing it, although whether they're actually recording the stuff and passing all of it through, or they're only recording all of the pen register data and then selectively doing it, I don't know. But anyway, but that's a digression. I think it's an interesting digression because it's issues that will really be coming up in your lifetime. All right, any other questions here? All right, why don't you sit down, and I wanted to say a bit more about 3D, and then maybe we can start on one more paper. And what I wanted to say really, and I'm not sure how much at this point I made before, but I did, I'll make it again, is that you've really got four stages that we're interested in the development of 3D printing, and they raise different issues. And the first stage is, I need a 3D printer to make me better. The first stage is now and near future. And that's a world where cheap 3D printers pretty soon will be able to make that cap. They'll be able to make fairly simple things. They'll be able to make pieces for games, but they won't be able to make anything very sophisticated. Fancy 3D printers will be able to do moderately sophisticated things, the kind of 3D printer that you might have somebody on the web offering to make things for you. Two is better printers cheap. Two is the point at which the equivalent of what you can now do with a $1 million machine, you can do with a $500 machine in your home, so to speak. And we don't know that'll happen, but it's going to happen with computers pretty quickly. It might happen with this technology. That's going to raise a different set of issues, right? At this point, you don't really worry about home printing pirating things. So there are going to be some baseball caps you can't collect money on. But you do worry, maybe, about how you control the people who are making copies of design patented stuff online, fairly sophisticated copies, and selling them. This one, you're now getting to the point, but where are they getting their CAD files? All right. So at this point, with the good printers, I can print a wide range of things, but I can't scan a wide range of things. I can't write out myself the design for a wide range of things. So at this point, if you can control the distribution of CAD files online, you're still pretty safe. But if you can't, there start being a significant number of things where people who want to control. Now, again, we have the point which Alfred raised, which is that as long as the IP isn't a large fraction of the cost, it isn't worth the trouble, because however good your machine is, almost certainly the machines the companies have are even better. But that becomes an issue. And the third is really good scanners. And that's the point where you've got 3D scanners that can actually look at what materials are. If you think about the equivalent of X-ray tomography or MRI, but cheap and working really well. Not sure we'll ever get there, but you could imagine that world. That's the point at which you've got the science fiction world where anybody can copy anything. And maybe it's a problem, maybe it isn't. If it turns out that copying it costs more than making it, maybe it's not a problem, but that's a very different world. And then point four, which is the one that I actually find much more interesting in all of this, is nanotech. And we'll get into that later. I think we've got at least one paper on it. If not, I'll make one out on it because it's an interesting subject. But basically, nanotech is the idea of being able to build machines at the atomic scale, which is how we ourselves are designed. And that gives you a world where once somebody has been able to make a general purpose assembler, which is a nanotech machine for building things, you have a general purpose assembler. You send it instructions for assembling atoms, and it picks up atoms from its environment. We got lots of sources of atoms, assembles them, and you've got whatever you want. And what, once you've got the world's first nanotech general purpose assembler, what is the very first thing you tell it to do?
Build
a copy of itself. Now you have 2, now you have 4, now you have 8, now you have 16, now you have 32, now you have 64, now you have 1,024, only takes 10 doublings. Now you have 1,000,000, it only takes 20 doublings. So at that point, if that breakthrough happens, you then have the possibility of a world where everybody has got the ability, given the design, you've still got the CAD problem, it's still the bottleneck, as it were. Because it's even more of a bottleneck, because if you think about how big a design it takes to design, to describe an automobile atom by atom, you'd never literally do that. You'd have this is what a cubic millimeter of the skin looks like, duplicated so many times. But somewhere in there, that cubic millimeter is made up of parts which ultimately are specified down to the atom. So it's going to be a huge file. So that becomes, as it were, the bottleneck. Yes?
So it's ironic because doesn't the self-looking replicator answer its own question, the entire question? Because if that kind of thing is enough of an incentive to not, then it will be invented. But if it is, then...
But the incentive doesn't go away until you've invented it, And somebody only has to invent it once.
Okay. Somebody who doesn't really understand economics will invent it?
Somebody can understand. There are lots of other reasons to do things other than that you're planning to sell them.
Okay.
Right? You could imagine lots of reasons why people would do it. But the argument is that you then really do have, what I'm really suggesting is that the world the authors of these things are playing with is a considerable exaggeration of the world that 3D printing will give us. But it might be a fairly accurate picture of the world that nanotech will give us, and therefore it's interesting from that standpoint as well. All right? I think those are the things I really wanted to talk about. So now why don't we have the paper that we were supposed to have had a while ago, which was the paper on medicine. You only had to wait a week or something to get there.
It's okay. Thank you guys for reading my paper. And I'd be interested too in, like, I had posed some questions in there, so if you have any information or any answers to those questions, that'd be really helpful. So I focused my paper on sort of two different aspects of HIV. I thought HIV was a good example because it shows the problems that have come up. Even, you know, since in the last 30, 40 years or so with the technology, like with biotech and ability, you know, now that we have, after sequencing, like, these human genome, that we have, you know, these problems arising with property rights and DNA. And I thought that was kind of a unique area of patent law, particularly because, like, the technology is growing so fast and so rapidly. And I thought HIV was interesting because it presents, it's a unique, you know, disease because it presents a couple different problems in patent law. And it's something where we've actually seen the identification of a whole different type of disease, like a whole new kind of virus. And then we've developed drugs to treat that, test for it. And now we're doing, you know, clinical trials on vaccinations. And that's all happened, you know, since the early 1980s. And so I think that's something that's interesting that we can see that evolution, like, literally in just what's relatively a short period of time. So the first part that I focused on was about sort of the story behind patenting the test for HIV. What's interesting about this, and there's a really good book written by a guy named Randy Schultz where he sort of, it's called In the Band Played On, where he talks about the bureaucratic and all the political aspects of and everything that went on developing in the first years, like 4 or 5 years after the first cases were identified in the United States. But what I found interesting about this was there were two different groups working. There was a patent race kind of going on. There were two different groups working on a test for HIV. So you had the French at the Pasteur Institute. And they had identified, they were initially working with this guy, Robert Gallo, who was at the National Institutes of Health, so working with a government, U.S. government agency. And he was a retrovirologist. And so he had a lot of incentive to be the first person sort of to win this patent race because he was up for, like, a Nobel Prize in medicine, and he wanted to he wanted to group HIV together with this other group of viruses that he'd been studying for a long time. So a lot of the things that I have read sort of suggested that was more of his motivation, like personal motivation. I'm not sure about the French. There's a lot that I've read about the motivations of the French, but it seems to be that they were collaborating together for a long time, or for the first, several years on this. And then at some point, there were accusations that, because the French sent samples that they'd isolated to Gallo's lab, and then there was a question of whether there was misappropriation, because Gallo took, it turned out the third party did a test, but the gene sequences were identified to come from the same patient, so it was clear that they came from the same source. And so both the French and Gallo published their findings in Nature, and they made up a name for the virus, so Gallo called it one thing and said it went with his family of retroviruses, and the French called it something else and said it was different. And then they also both filed for a patent in the United States on a test. And the French were really upset because Gallo, his findings were published after theirs, and they applied first in the United States for the patent. And Gallo's was his patent application was granted by the patent examiner first. So they were upset. And
meaning that he offered evidence that he had invented first?
No. He didn't have, no. He actually was published second after the
not
French.
Published, invented. In theory, patent until very recently went to the first to invent.
Yes, but there wasn't good at, the French, I think, had evidence that supporting them.
So
I'm
what
not
was
sure
the basis
why,
on which he got the patent? You don't know?
I'm not sure why the examiner, not sure. I'm not sure if it was some bias or something because he was an American. I'm not really sure. But there ended up being a lot of litigation going on for a couple of years until they decided who was going to split the royalties, because a lot of money was generated, millions and millions of dollars in royalties from this test. Some of it went to the individual researchers, so like Gallo got some of it, and the guy who was leading the French lab, Montagnier, got some of it. And then some went to the United States government because Gallo was working for the government agency. And so I thought that raised some real interesting questions because, about incentives and what, and also like during this time period, because HIV was in the blood supply, and so when the delay of releasing a public test for it, a lot of people died during that time because people weren't able to be tested and they weren't testing, like the Red Cross was not testing the blood supply. So I thought that raised some interesting questions about what's the proper, incentives. And in this case, should a patent even have been awarded? I mean, when you're talking about there's a cost of human lives that are being lost, in those cases, is it the patent race, is it really worth it for the ultimate cost goes to the public? And so I thought that raised some interesting questions. I also, the other part of the paper, and I apologize, I hope this wasn't, I kind of had two different ideas, and I was trying to push them both together in the same paper, so if that doesn't work well, let me know, because I might just focus on one of these. The other was the Delta 32 mutation. This kind of gets into patenting of DNA materials, so patenting people's DNA sequences. And so this is interesting because there's a mutation that confers some resistance to HIV that's prevalent in a small percentage of the population. And people that have two copies of the gene like end up having, appear to have total resistance to HIV. People with one copy progress slower than people who don't have that mutation. And so what was interesting is they've actually studied, there were two guys that kind of volunteered themselves. And to be studied, and so they were followed for a period of time, and again they volunteered. They called different research labs to get in on these clinical trials. And so,
did they realize that there was something odd going on?
Yes.
So both of them had spotted the fact that they should have gotten HIV and hadn't.
And everyone else around them had died. One guy said he lost like 70 or 80 friends, and he didn't. So he was wondering, why am I still here, and why don't they want to study me? So they donated their blood, and then they were able to find out that these guys both had this mutation. And they had just bombarded their blood samples with the HIV virus and HIV, and it wasn't infecting their cells. And so this went. So further research showed, identified this mutation, and they were eventually developed a whole new class of HIV drugs based off of this. I was reading articles or interviews with these two men, and they both expressed they were upset, not really with the researchers, but just in general that they weren't receiving any royalties from this because, for one, they developed a whole class of medications, but they also developed now a test that you can take that tells you if you have this mutation. So these guys felt like they should have received something because it was their blood they were donated. And it came from their bodies, and they didn't understand. They felt like they had a right in all these subsequent, you know, medical, in the technology that was developed from, you know, research based off of what came from their bodies. So I think that raises another interesting set of questions about, you know, who, where does the intellectual property right, you know, lie? Should it lie with the people who and the things that they, parts of their bodies they've actually, because you can think about like the ultimate property right we kind of all think of would be sort of in our own physical bodies. And then research that's developed from things taken out of our physical bodies, do we have any kind of, rights to that? Or is it the researchers, because they're the ones who kind of done the intellectual work and taken that inventive step to transform that into something more. So I thought that was another issue that hasn't really been explored. We haven't identified it, where those lies lie really, even with the myriad, the court decision that came out earlier this year. I think it's still kind of unclear, whose property rights we're talking about and whether or not maybe people should have some kind of IP right, even if they weren't the ones who were really taking that intellectual transformative step. So those are sort of the questions that if you guys have any feedback, yeah.
So back to your first kind of issue, the point of the granting the patent protection is that we'll get the cure more quickly if we grant somebody the patent protection. And so the people that were dying in the period while there was all this hubbub about who gets the patent, who gets to do the test, those people would not have had a test at all, in theory, if patent protection does what it says it does, if they hadn't had the incentives to create the cure in the first place.
Perhaps. There have been other researchers who, and there was a guy who, one of the researchers proposed that they, an interim test until, because he'd been working on hepatitis, and so he proposed that they use that sort of as a screening tool. So it seems that there are claims that there are groups of scientists who are just purely, you know, motivated by altruism, and they don't care about making a profit off of anything. And so they would have released their findings and made everything public right away, and there would never have been.
Except that no such team had, in fact, developed this thing, and the two teams who did want the patent did develop it, right?
Yes, and because they're all working under these hierarchies, I think, yeah, it's more complicated.
Now, it seems to me that the problem with your argument is that if it's right, it's right for everything. That is to say, this part of the argument, you're saying this is too important to do with the patent system. But if the patent system makes things work better, then it's even more important for the important things. And if it makes things work worse, then you shouldn't be using it for the unimportant ones either. So you have to somehow, if you want to argue that we should not have a patent for this sort of thing but should for other things, you've got to not just say this is important. That's irrelevant. You've got to say, why is this something where patent makes things worse and something else where it doesn't? Does that make sense?
Yes.
That seems to be a weakness in a lot of this argument, that it sort of sounds rhetorically persuasive to say, well, there are lives lost. Well, yes, but there are lives lost if you don't have a patent and if that's the wrong answer.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and when you have something, I think it's different, a little bit different when you have something like a emerging, you know, outbreak of an infectious disease where it's being transmitted very quickly. You aren't entirely sure how many people globally have been exposed and has the potential to kill millions of people. And when it's something that's like really time sensitive like that, I think that might be fall under the category of where, you know, more of a public health concern. Rather, you know, putting that, you know, maybe.
But I just don't see why it changes it. That it seems to me, I'm not saying there aren't any changes, but just saying that huge amounts are at stake, mm-hmm. either is a strong argument against patent and a weak argument against patent for everything else, or a strong argument for patent and a weak argument for patent for everything else, right? Saying you've raised the stakes doesn't tell you whether patents make things better or worse. Now, maybe what you want to argue is not that, but that somehow there ought to be some procedure so that while the patent dispute is going on, there is a way in which you can make the product available and then say, all right, we'll have a compulsory license temporarily, and when we settle who has the patent, we decide who gets the money. I mean, you can think of various ways you could modify it. But I just don't think that just saying a lot is at stake really gets you very far.
Yeah, well, no, I agree. I guess I'm not arguing that you know, patents should be abolished completely, even in cases like this. I just saw, you know, this is a potential problem with something that did historically, you know, happen. And so I think that you're absolutely right, looking at other methods that they could have done to, you know, for people, because if you do have higher stakes, then maybe other precautions should be taken. Other things could happen.
Maybe. Yeah. But the other thing, of course, is the stakes are potentially high in all sorts of IP, mm-hmm. right? If you think about it, a book that persuades people for democracy might save more lives than an HIV cure. And a technological invention that raises real incomes, life expectancy is very sensitive to incomes. So, you know, there are all sorts of things where lives are at stake. I mean, I think that's, anyway. But it just seems to me the more interesting question really is less that lives are at stake than that speed is important. So if you say, should we have mechanisms for situations where it matters not only whether the invention comes out, but once it's discovered, how quickly it's available?
Yeah.
And one of the things that wasn't clear to me in your story is why it was delayed at all. That is, why didn't the two teams make a contract saying, look, we will jointly license this temporarily, and when we finish litigating it, we find out who gets the money?
They did that eventually. Why they didn't do it sooner, it seems to be that the French were really upset because they felt that this other guy had literally stolen their samples and published it under his name. And there was so much animosity there that they weren't even willing to talk or negotiate. And that went on for a couple of years.
But if he had a patent initially, why didn't he just license the patent and say, you people can sue me if you like, we can argue about it in court? Well, frankly, why did it slow the availability of the test that one person had gotten a patent and someone else said he shouldn't?
Because the French were challenging it and saying that he actually didn't invent it, and they were actually alleging fraud.
I understand, but given all of those challenges, I'm a pharmaceutical company that wants to make the test available. Why do I care whether the French are challenging the patent? If you can answer that, that might tell you how patent law maybe should be changed so that they wouldn't care.
I know there was an issue because it was being manufactured in the United States separately and in France separately. I know the French tests were selling a lot. They weren't selling very many. So the United States were the main distributors of the test, really. So
wait, you're saying the U.S. was distributing the test. I thought you said it wasn't available because of the patent dispute.
Well, no, eventually after that, even after that. So I'm not sure, but, yeah, I don't know.
The day after the patent came out, why didn't the guy in America license people and have them produce them? Would there be... Let me put it as a law question. Maybe somebody can answer. Suppose that the American one licenses it to me. I produce a whole lot of kits. And a year later, the French win their case. Do I owe anything to the French? Am I in any legal trouble given that it was a patent, that until the patent was declared invalid, I was acting under a license? I don't owe the French anything for a patent they haven't yet been granted, do I?
I think there are, I don't know, I think it's, if they're alleging, fraud, I think that it makes it change, it makes it different.
But how does it make it different for the third party?
For the distributor of the test.
The distributor of the test has gotten a license from the person who held the patent at the time, and a year later he is stripped of the patent on grounds of fraud. What happens to the distributor of the test?
I think they might. I'm not sure, but I would suspect they could run into legal problems if they were distributing a test and licensing it from somebody who shouldn't have had the patent in the first place.
But he did have the patent. Anyway, yes?
Well, the patent wasn't valid because it never existed, so I think they wouldn't still be liable.
If the patent never existed, they're not liable to anybody.
Well, that's true, yeah. I mean,
they're only liable if you somehow say that the French retroactively get the patent.
Yeah,
but we should be going. We're out of time. Thank you. It's interesting. We may want to continue this discussion next time. We'll see before we get into the next. There are lots more interesting stuff to talk about.